promote the full distribution of public information to obtain access to sources of news not commonly brought together,
and to employ such varied sources in the public presentation of accurate, objective, comprehensive news on all matters
vitally affecting the community.
The Pacifica Mission Statement.
Hi, this is Ricky Lee Jones. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM LA, 98.7 Santa Barbara.
So consumption is good. It doesn't matter even if it's based on debt. We want more of it. That's a good thing. So our news media, which perhaps could be the space in which we're debating these things, is actually a space in which we're replicating the same ideas. What we need to do, if we're going to think about other forms of progress, is to create more imaginative space. We need to change the way governments operate. Currently, governments intervene to support consumer capitalism, to sustain it and to limit its externalities, based on a model of built-in obsolescence.
That's Justin Lewis, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Justin Lewis on consumer capitalism. René Descartes, the 17th century French philosopher, once said, "I think, therefore I am." In today's context, it may be more like, "I buy, therefore I am." Orchestrated wants driven by sophisticated advertising techniques have created a culture of consumption. Appetites for the latest hot thing are manufactured. Media campaigns sell cool and sexy. Data are collected. People are profiled and then targeted. Take cell phones. You have to get the latest one with all the new features. We can't be left behind. The capitalist economic system is predicated on making money and barely considers the environmental effects down the road. That's somebody else's problem. In the U.S., consumerism is connected to ideology. Freedom is equated with the ability to buy things. But the pattern of endless consumer capitalism is not sustainable. Our guest today is Justin Lewis. He's professor of communication at the School of Journalism at Cardiff University in the UK. He has written widely about media, culture, and politics. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. And now, Justin Lewis on consumer capitalism.
Okay, today I'm going to talk about dominant economic, social, cultural, political system, consumer capitalism. Consumer capitalism over the last two centuries has come in for a great deal of analysis and criticism, but as a system, it's always had a trump card to play, which has ensured its success and survival into the 21st century. It's always been able to say that it was probably the best system for wealth creation around. And because of that, the system has survived and indeed is, in many ways, flourishing unrivaled in our current society. At the heart of the success of this model lie two linked ideas. The first is an image of the good life based upon the accumulation of consumer goods. And the second is the idea of perpetual and infinite economic growth. Both those notions have become central to our political and cultural life. What I want to argue today is that both those ideas are beginning to unravel, and that there are a new set of conditions in the 21st century which means that consumer capitalism may be past its sell-by date, and that consumer capitalism as a model for human progress may no longer be fit for purpose, even on its own terms. The system's genius for proliferation, for turning nature into kind of dazzling aisles of consumer goods, is based on the idea that its benefits are infinite. That comes crashing up against various ideas that are finite, because the benefits of proliferation, I want to argue, are not infinite. They are finite. There are, for developed countries in the world, I think now in the 21st century, three problems with consumer capitalism as a model of human progress. And all of them relate to this idea of the finite clashing with an infinite model of perpetual growth. The first of them is economic. Now, at the heart of consumer capitalism is an idea which really, I think, is based on a fundamental limit of imagination. This is a system that can never imagine a world in which we have enough stuff. It always imagines that we will perpetually need more, that no matter how much stuff we accumulate, there will always be a need for more. There will never be a point where we say, actually, we've got enough stuff. Let's think about what we might do with that stuff, or let's think about doing something else. Can never imagine that moment. And from that point of view, the system itself has at its heart a fundamental limit of imagination. Now, economically, there are two major problems with that vision. The first we could call the problem of diminishing returns. Now, the law of diminishing returns in economics usually applies to production. But there's also a sense in which the law of diminishing returns applies to consumption. In other words, the value of every new object that we acquire will diminish depending on how many objects we already have. So, for example, if we've got two items of furniture and we acquire a third item of furniture, say we've got a bed and a table, and then we get a chair, that will have a significant value. That will probably improve our quality of life in a significant way. If we have 102 items of furniture and we acquire 103rd, well, you know, it might be nice. It might be fun for a while. It may end up in 6 months' time in the attic. It may not. But its value to us is going to be proportionately less. It will plateau as we accumulate more and more objects. Now, the system doesn't really get that. The system assumes that the value of every new object that we acquire is equal to the one that preceded it. So within this system is a basic flaw that does not appreciate the law of diminishing returns in consumption. But a more profound limit, I think, is the clash between time and money. So within the system, there is, if you like, a contradiction between the endless proliferation of goods on which the system depends and the limited amount of time we have to buy those goods, to use those goods, to enjoy those goods, or indeed to dispose of those goods. The system keeps producing more and more, but the time we have available to do all those things, especially over the last 50 years, remains static. So we get more and more stuff, but the time we have available to deal with it remains the same. Now, at some point, those two things are going to come crashing up against each other, and the tension between them will get more and more burdensome, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. I mean, the superabundance that we enjoy, well, enjoy a little bit at least, today, is so pervasive now that we can hardly begin to appreciate it. And I think you have to get a sense of how striking that is, you have to look back. In the 1920s, an advertiser back in the 1920s plaintively complained about the proliferation of goods that he saw in the 1920s. He actually said that that most products were so heavily advertised that they were, and I quote, scratching gravel from the bottom of consumer demand. The grocer and the chemist looked despairingly at their crowded shelves when asked to find places for another breakfast food or a new toothpaste. Now, that was 1927. I mean, looking back at that, you know, this seems like a period of austerity compared with now. Now, of course, what happened is they did find space for the new toothpaste, then another new toothpaste, and another new toothpaste. The shops got much bigger, the shelves got more extensive, and we moved forward to the 1950s when there were far more things. And by the 1950s, we really do begin to enter consumer culture as we now know it. And you get a series of commentators in the 1950s that begin now to see that there's this paradigm shift, that we are now in a world in which we become fixated with the idea of accumulating more things. We become fixated with the idea that we must have more economic growth. We must have more stuff to be happy. You also see, from the 1950s onwards, a profound shift in our desires. From about 1900 to about 1950, our twin desires are for more things, more money, so we can buy more things, and for more time in which to enjoy those things. So the first half of the 20th century, you see an increase in our leisure time of about 15 to 20 hours over that period. It goes from around 55 to 60 hours a week to around 40 hours a week that we're working by mid-century. And that has a certain logic to it. If we have more stuff, it's good to have more time to buy and enjoy the stuff. In the second half of the century, that changes. We still acquire more stuff. In fact, we acquire it at an ever-increasing rate, especially in the 60s and 70s. But the time we have to buy that stuff and to consume it starts to remain static. So decreases in the working week start to diminish by mid-century. And while many people in mid-century, many thinkers, were looking ahead to the year 2000 as a period where we would probably be working around 4 hours a day, that didn't happen. We got stuck on around a 35, 40-hour week. And that created a contradiction, because it meant that the new stuff that we were accumulating took place at a time or in a space where we were battling against the lack of time within which to deal with it. A historian called Benjamin Honeycutt writes about this, and writes about the way in which our desire for more leisure has been eclipsed by our need to maximise our income so we can have more stuff. So, you know, labour unions and others no longer really demand more time. They're focused on demanding more money for more things. Even though all the research shows us that actually most of us would benefit far more in terms of our quality of life from more time than we would for more things. And yet that's gone away. To quote him, he wrote, "The dreams of the utopian writers of the four-hour day and the hopes of those who believe that progress involved leisure as much as it involved economic growth have evaporated. And labour's old demand for the progressive shortening of the hours of labour has been forgotten." Now, that's quite remarkable that that has happened. And I'll talk more about why that's happened in a little while. By 1970, we really did live in an age of plenty, such that writers like Staffan Linde wrote about the problems of leisure at a time of superabundance. He wrote a book called The Harried Leisure Class, in which he talked about the way that we have so many things thrust at us that leisure itself has become less leisurely. It's no longer relaxing because we've got to consume so many things at any one time. And we will all know that because of the way we experience leisure, or indeed, in my case especially, the way our children enjoy leisure. So for my daughter, for example, who's 16, leisure is often about doing at least three things at once, just to be able to accommodate all the things that are around that she wants to be able to do. Now, that continued, so even though 1970 was in many ways an age of plenty, people didn't lack for things in the 1920s. They didn't lack for culture, for experience, for objects to enjoy. But the proportion of goods on the supermarket shelf since 1975 has gone up by five times since then. There are five times as many products on our supermarket shelves as there were back in 1975. And we've really reached a point now where this proliferation of commodities has become difficult to negotiate. And let me give you one example. We went into my local supermarket the other month to count just how many different varieties there were of a couple of different types of products. So we counted how many different varieties of shampoo you could buy in that supermarket. So we went in there with our clipboards and, you know, we got few strange looks, but we counted and wrote down all the different types of shampoo that you could buy. And we found 188 different types of shampoo. Now, think about that for a moment. Think about how you deal with that level of choice. If you were going to try and make a rational decision about which shampoo to buy, it would be a major research project. You would probably have to apply for a grant to carry it out. You would have to employ a legion of research assistants to work for you, all of whom you'd have to analyse the chemical construction of every shampoo bottle, how it was suited to your own particular hair type and colour, and then carry out various forms of analysis about which shampoo was best for you out of the 188. By the time you'd finished, of course, the number would no longer be 188, it would probably be larger, so you'd have to carry on and on and on. Now, clearly, that's not what we're going to do. And here lies a troubling fact for consumer capitalism. Because at the heart of consumer capitalism, the figure that gives it its central logic is somebody called the rational consumer. The rational consumer makes rational decisions about the best product at the best price. That keeps the whole system ticking over and supplies its central logic. But if the rational consumer says, look, I can't make a rational decision here, there are just too many of them, I'll have to behave differently. In fact, the rational consumer, if they are rational, will make the rational decision that there's not enough time to be a rational consumer. So in the 21st century, we have the catch-22, that the rational consumer makes the rational decision to give up being a rational consumer. It's simply not possible any longer. This exasperates those both in business and in government. In my own country, in the UK, the government wanted to give people more choice in terms of where they got their energy from, their electricity, their gas. So they encouraged a proliferation of different companies to enter the market. So we all had a choice about where we could buy our energy from. And the thinking was that would mean we as rational consumers would favour the people that supplied the best energy at the best price. And so they would prosper and others would not. But there's a problem. Most of us don't want to spend our time researching which energy company is providing the best deal. So we don't. In fact, the government did research and it found that in the previous year, despite encouraging us to behave like rational consumers, only 15% of people switched energy supplier during that year. And in fact, what they discovered was that we were spending probably on average £200 more than we needed to, or $300 more than we needed to, because we were not behaving as they saw it like rational consumers. We were saying, forget it. I don't want to spend my time researching the various companies and who's offering the best deal. It's complicated. I've got other better things to do. So now we have the bizarre situation of a government nagging people to behave like a rational consumer. And if you think about that, you'll realise just how bizarre that is. The truth is that we've now reached a point in the 21st century where the dividing line between the point where choice is an opportunity and where choice has become a burden is being crossed increasingly often. Choice now is increasingly a problem that we need to negotiate. The second problem with consumer capitalism, I think, follows very much from the first, and that has to do with its social aspects. Consumer capitalism claims, its central claim, is that we will all be happier and healthier if we consume more. That claim now reverberates around the echo chamber of advertising with an increasingly hollow ring. There has been a burgeoning in the last two decades of what we might call quality of life research. Research that looks at the things that make up our quality of life. And it usually consists of two kinds of measurements. Some of them are fairly objective forms of measurement. So look at how healthy we are physically, how healthy we are psychologically, looking at how our lives might be free from crime. It also looks at sort of softer measurements, like the way we report our state of happiness, our state of well-being, how meaningful our lives are. All of that research has begun to show something quite striking. And that is this, that up to a certain point, increases in GDP growth have a positive effect on our well-being and quality of life. But past a certain point, a point that most of us in developed countries reached between sort of 20 and 50 years ago. Past a certain point, the relationship between GDP growth and quality of life begins to disintegrate and disappears altogether. So here in the US, we have come to a point now where there is no connection at all between GDP growth and quality of life. So if in the US we experience, you know, a fantastic period of you know, 4% growth a year over the next 10 years, that will have no impact at all on our quality of life. Now that is a pretty striking finding, and it's repeated in study after study after study. There's a somebody who's researched this in Britain called Richard Layard, and he puts it like this. He says, people in the West have got no happier in the last 50 years. They've become much richer, but they are no happier. This shocking fact should be the starting point for much of our social science. Well, I'd go further than that and say this fact should be the starting point for our politics. Because if that's true, why are all our politicians obsessed, particularly now, with creating more economic growth? Why? What's it for? What's the point of it? What does it give us? What does it deliver? It's not so clear. Research also shows, in fact, that excessive materialism actually has a negative impact on our well-being. So various people, Tim Kasser, Juliet Shaw, Alvin Offer, have researched this and found that, in fact, an excessive materialistic values, an excessive involvement in the world of consumption, actually makes us more miserable. That actually our quality of life deteriorates when we do that. And the reason for that is because it pushes us away from those things that often do make us happy or fulfilled and contented, and that's the social aspects of life. If we're obsessed with simply acquiring objects, we're doing less of that. And it's those relationships that often supply us with meaning and fulfillment rather than the less fulfilling retail therapy of the shopping mall. The third problem with consumer capitalism in the 21st century is perhaps the best known. And I think in some ways it's both the most serious, but also the most solvable of the three problems. And that's the environmental problems that result from consumer capitalism. I mean, there's a basic problem here that most of us are aware of, that a system demanding infinite growth in a world that is finite is inevitably going to come up against problems at some point. Now, that is very serious because the consequences of the clash between economic growth and the environment are potentially very serious indeed and could be catastrophic, leading to widespread loss of life. But they're also arguably, and I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't put this too strongly, but there are those that argue that they're also fixable. I mean, the other problems I talked about are not fixable. You know, we simply will not increase the amount of time we have available in proportion to the increase in consumer goods. That's not going to change. Even if our leisure time does increase, it will still be an end point. We will not live forever. But this is potentially solvable, and optimistic market theorists will say, yeah, okay, we might have a limited number of resources now, we might be running out of certain kinds of minerals and fuels, but you know, those will become more expensive, so we'll have technological breakthroughs that will mean we'll fix those problems, we'll have cheaper, cleaner forms of energy, those will be developed, we'll do more with less. Now, that may happen, it may not, but at least we have to acknowledge it's possible. But the main problem with consumer capitalism is to do with the word that economists use, which is the word externalities. And this is a bit like, for me, this is a bit like when people in the military talk about collateral damage. It's a innocent-sounding phrase that, you know, doesn't sound like it could be that bad. But actually, it conceals a great deal of damage. And the externalities to do with the environment that are the consequence of consumer capitalism are fairly profound. And I'll just mention two. One of the externalities of consumer capitalism is that we produce vast amounts of waste. We produce waste when we make things. We produce waste when we transport things. We produce waste when we consume things and throw them away. And the volume of waste that we produce increases every year. The World Bank estimates that we currently produce 1.3 billion tonnes of municipal waste every year, and they predict that will rise to 2.2 billion tonnes by 2025. Now, one of the problems here is that the cost of dealing with all that waste is quite considerable. It costs a lot of money to deal with waste, and that cost is not borne by the people that produce it. They are subsidised. The whole system of consumer capitalism has a huge inbuilt subsidy, which is it produces vast amounts of waste, but the people who pay to deal with that waste are the public. And the annual cost of dealing with all that waste is considerable. It's about $205 billion a year. And for poorer cities and towns, that's a huge drain on their resources. The World Bank estimate that for certain poorer cities in the world, roughly 20 to 50% of their budgets just go on disposing of all that stuff, all that waste. Now, that means they're not able to spend money on things that we'd like them to spend money on, things like health or education, because it's all spent, if you like, subsidising just one externality of consumer capitalism. So it comes at a very high price. But the mother of all externalities, and I'm borrowing here from the economist Nicholas Stern, is climate change. The fact that consumer capitalism relies for its production on generating fossil fuels that go into the atmosphere and create a kind of seal around the atmosphere, which means that the planet gets warmer. And that then affects the ecosystems in which we live. Now, we've known about climate change for a long time, over 100 years. People have been working on climate change, but it started to get particularly critical in the 1980s when more and more researchers from across a whole range of fields to do with climate science were talking about the critical levels that we might reach in the next few decades, because they saw that greenhouse gases were being produced at an ever-increasing rate, and the scale of that activity was now matching the scale of the Earth, and that the Earth may change as a consequence. As a result of that concern, I mean, many people from across the political spectrum were concerned about this. Margaret Thatcher, not somebody that we associate as being a great environmentalist, she made a speech about climate change in 1988, about the worrying trend of climate change and what we should do about it. That led to the United Nations bringing the world's best experts across the various fields of climate science together to produce the most definitive and comprehensive report they could on climate change, about what the dangers were, what might happen, what we might do about it. And they produced their first fairly definitive report in 1990, well over 20 years ago now. That report said that it was very likely that if we carried on going the way we were going, there would be various climate changes over the next few decades that could have significant and, if unchecked, catastrophic impacts for life on Earth. Ecosystems will become unstable and may be destroyed, making life uninhabitable for hundreds of millions of people. So the stakes were very high. As many of you will know, they produced a succession of reports since then. The science stacks up and up and up. And one of the striking things, really, is even the most recent report, is how accurate the 1990 report appears to have been. What have we done? What did we do after 1990? I mean, this was really alarming. If you go back and read the 1990 report, it was really alarming what was contained therein. And governments were a little alarmed. And what have we done about that? Well, what we've done is make the problem worse. Since 1990, the level of greenhouse gas emissions produced globally has not stabilised. It has increased by 40%. It's as if we're playing a kind of game, sort of a game of dare, of brinksmanship with the science, saying, well, let's just rack it up a little bit more. Let's just see if this climate change thing is really going to happen. Let's just pump more gases into the environment just to see if it really is going to happen. It's just a giant chemical experiment. But the stakes are really too high for that. Now, why aren't we doing anything about it? Is one, in some ways, one of the most extraordinary questions of our time. I mean, we're pretty risk averse normally. Ulrich Beck, the sociologist, said that we live in a risk society now where we worry about all kinds of things that will never happen. You know, we worry about our children being abducted by strangers. You know, the chances of that happening are absolutely minuscule. We worry about, you know, diseases that might be imported by various animals in various ways. We worry about all kinds of things that will probably never happen. And yet, when faced with huge amounts of evidence of something that will have devastating consequences, they're pretty relaxed. You know, so, yeah, okay, yeah, whatever. So it gets a bit warmer. You know, if we're in a cold part of the world, that would be quite nice. Be all right. We can live with that. Unfortunately, it is rather more serious. As the NASA climate scientist James Hansen and colleagues put it, continued growth of greenhouse gas emissions for just another decade practically eliminates the possibility of near-term return of atmospheric composition beneath the tipping level for catastrophic effects. Now, this is a manifestly solvable problem. We know what the problem is. We know how to fix it. We could fix it tomorrow if we wanted, but we don't. And the reason why we don't is because consumer capitalism makes it very difficult for us to do that for two reasons. One, consumer capitalism is not very good at thinking in the medium or the long term. So because the effects of climate change usually take a few decades to manifest themselves, I mean, the span of human history, that's not very long, but for consumer capitalism, that's way too long to really plan for or think ahead. The other problem with consumer capitalism here is that one of the solutions to climate change is something it simply cannot comprehend. One of the solutions is that we start to consume less. And that's something that consumer capitalism just says, hang on, you know, what? No, it just doesn't compute. Don't understand. That's not something that we can do. That's just simply not possible within these systems.
You're listening to Justin Lewis on consumer capitalism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
So climate change, from that point of view, it's a function of living in a finite world, but it's beyond the philosophical imagination of a system premised on infinite growth. So, just to sum up the problems. Consumer capitalism has become economically incoherent. It's no longer capable of making us healthier or happier, and it risks jeopardizing the ecosystems on which we depend. So we should ask, at this point, what would a happier, more fulfilling model of society, what would a better model of progress look like? But we're too busy consuming to even ask the question. So what's the problem here? Why don't we start to think about other models? Well, the reason, I think, has to do with our media and communications industries. And I want to just mention three of them today. And the first of them has to do with the way in which our media and consumer communications industries are structured around certain kinds of commercial imperatives and certain kinds of business models. This is an industry that's very important economically. It's about 7% of global economic activity. That's a pretty big chunk for a sector, and that's growing. It's growing at a faster rate than most other sectors. But much more important than that, this is a sector that dominates our waking hours. This is a sector like no other. This is a sector that has a command over our attention that no other sector gets close to. People in the United States spend around 68 hours a week consuming media. That's a long time. That's more time than we're likely to spend doing the other two things that dominate our lives, which is working or sleeping. You know, 50 or 100 years ago, you'd say that humans on the whole, most of them do two things, adults. They work and then they sleep and then they do a bunch of other things. Now we'd say they work, they sleep, they consume media, and then there's not really a lot of time left for anything else. So this has become a fundamental part of life today. The way the industry operates, therefore, is very important because it's likely to have a greater impact on the way we think than other industries are. Now, you know, there could be major breakthroughs that could take us a kind of a great leap forward, but it's not in their interest to do that. It's in their interests to do things in a way that maximizes their business opportunity. And as a result, they are in the vanguard of something that we call planned or built-in obsolescence. The idea that to be as profitable as possible means producing something that will become useless as quickly as possible. And the quicker you can do that, the more this thing becomes obsolete quickly, the more money you will make, because you can keep on selling it to us over and over and over again. It's a business model that this industry, above all others, has become fantastically skilled at. It has a genius for built-in obsolescence. So companies like Apple, that have a real flair for this thing, now operate on the principle that everything that Apple produces, they will be working to make sure that it needs to be replaced in a period of 12 to 18 months so that you'll buy the next thing and keep on buying the next thing. As Jonathan Stern put it, this is an industry in which obsolescence is not only planned, but forced and engineered. And there are many, many examples of that. You just think about many of the sort of changes that we've seen in technology. So, for example, the change when we move from vinyl to CD. We move from vinyl to CD not because people said, we want CDs, they're better than vinyl. That's not why it happened. It happened because the industry realized there was money to be made in switching the technology on which people listen to music. One, you could sell people new stuff, so you could sell them CD players. Two, you could sell them the music they already had all over again. It's a very nice business model. Remarkably, we now see CDs becoming obsolete and vinyl making a comeback. In fact, sales of vinyl have gone up year on year over the last few years. And in fact, the head of the recorded music group at Warner Music Group, one of the biggest music groups in the world, suggested that, and I quote, "Vinyl will definitely outlast CDs because of the resonance, the sound." Now, this from an industry that said, forget about vinyl, it's all about CDs. Now, what that tells you is that it's not really about progress, it's about change, and changing as often as possible. And it doesn't really matter whether the change is an improvement or not. All that really matters is that you make the change. And you can see that in every place you look. Phones. I remember when phones, the style of a phone, was emblematic of a whole decade. So, you know, you'd see a movie from the 1960s and there'd be a phone in it. And you'd think, yep, that's a 1960s phone. That phone, you know, speaks to the style of the 1960s. The average life of a phone now is 12 to 18 months. And the vast majority of the phones that we throw away are in perfect working order when we get rid of them. So we've gone from a period of replacement that was around a decade to one that's around 12 to 18 months. Computers. Computers are based on a principle of a kind of symbiotic relationship between software and hardware, which requires us to upgrade them. And usually upgrading one requires you to upgrade the other. So you have to buy new computers for the software, new software for the computers, and so on and so on. Now, early on, you know, the upgrades really were an upgrade. You thought, yeah, this is definitely better than one I had before. But I suspect most of you, the last time you experienced an upgrade, didn't feel that. I certainly didn't. I thought, okay, right, this is a bit annoying. I've got to learn all the things I used to be able to do in a new way. And it's different, but it's not obviously better. It's just a change. I went to a talk a couple of months ago with somebody from government whose job it was to use new technologies to deliver public services in a way that improved people's quality of life, in a way. He said he went to a meeting. He was a real enthusiast for the technology. And he said he went to a meeting with some of the leaders in the industry, with Apple and Microsoft and others. And they asked him, they said to him, what could we do for you? What would be the piece of advice you would give us? And he said, three words. Please slow down. You know, I spent all my time worrying about the next upgrade, about all the stuff I'm going to have to chuck out and replace, and the amount of money that's going to cost me, that I don't really have time to think about the socially useful aspects of the technology. I need the time and space and help to do that. But that was not the business model that they were working with. Now, all this has a huge environmental cost. Just take one device, video game consoles, just one electronic device. In the United States, video game consoles collectively consume electricity at the same rate as the entire city of San Diego. That's the ninth largest city in the US. One device. And actually, that's not the real problem here. The amount of electricity they consume when we're running them is not the main environmental problem, because actually these devices consume four times as much resource in their production as they do in their use. So the real problem here is not their lack of energy efficiency when we use them, it's the fact that we keep replacing them. And the more often we do it, the worse it becomes. And we certainly are doing it pretty often. The average US household spends over $1,400 a year on a total of 500 million consumer electronic devices every year. The US Consumer Electronics Association suggested that global spending on consumer technology devices surpassed $1 trillion in 2012. Now, this is very resource-intensive activity. I mean, the average computer and monitor uses huge resources in its production. It requires something like 530 pounds of fossil fuels to produce it, 50 pounds of chemicals, and 3,300 pounds of water. That's roughly the same resources you need to produce an SUV every time you get a new computer. And if you have a system that says computers will last you five years if you're lucky, then you are on a very damaging environmental course. But the main problem here, I think, is an ideological one. That because this is an industry that dominates our sort of waking hours, the way it operates has an effect on the way we think about progress. And what I would suggest is that this industry has encouraged us to think that human progress is all about the replacement of commodities. That if we're not chucking the old thing away and buying something new as often as possible, then we're not progressing. That's how we think about it. We don't think about, well, progress is what we do with the objects. You know, progress is if the objects make our lives more fulfilling, make us smarter, mean that we know more. That's what progress would look like, we could say, but that's not the model that we're given. And indeed, this huge proliferation of electronic devices has had zero impact on how smart we are, what we know, and our happiness and the meaning of our lives. No impact at all. Now, we should say, well, hang on, if that's true, maybe we're doing it wrong. You know, we should be becoming more knowledgeable. We should be having our cultural horizons lifted. If it's not doing that, we're doing something wrong. But the model doesn't encourage us to ask that question. The second problem is to do with our dominant cultural industry. The Disney Corporation used the term, you may have heard of it, the Imagineer. Disney Imagineers. They're people who sculpt and construct imaginative landscapes for the Disney Corporation. We have created a culture in which our principal Imagineers are in the advertising industry. It's the greatest concentration of creative talent and energy that we have. And it's grown hugely over the last 100 and especially the last 50 years. Now, the irony, of course, is the more stuff we have, the more we need it. So, you know, advertising in the developed world has to work harder and harder the more we have. So it has grown at a faster and faster rate. Global advertising spending grew from $7.5 billion in 1950 to $72 billion by the end of the 1970s. By the end of 2011, we were spending $500 billion a year, most of it in the wealthy developed world, on advertising, trying to persuade people to buy more stuff. Now, that is a mammoth cultural effort, one that dwarfs other kinds of cultural efforts that we make. So the amount we spend on advertising is 15 times the size of the global box office of all films produced in a given year. 15 times bigger. It's a massive concentration of artistic energy. We have chosen to make our dominant cultural industry the industry that produces precisely that state of wanting. And it's everywhere. It has transformed every cultural industry that we can think of. Take the internet. I mean, I remember my colleague, Michael Morgan, who's here, when the internet first began to develop, the World Wide Web, showing me how it worked and saying, this is this fantastic public space that's just been created, where all this information can be exchanged. This massive public sphere has been created. And it is remarkable. But in the space of a very short time, the internet has become mainly, economically, a way of delivering audiences to advertisers in increasingly sophisticated ways. And any of you that know about the way that things like Facebook work will know how sophisticated that has become. But that's mainly what it's about. That's mainly where it's funded from. For it's not funded by public money, it's funded by advertising. Television. In some countries, television began as a medium that had no advertising at all. In my own country, in Britain, when television began, there was no advertising on it. Now, in countries like Britain, there has been a proliferation of channels, and most of them have more advertising on than they have ever had. There's more advertising on American television than there has ever been at any point in the history of American broadcasting. Recent surveys suggest that 41% of viewing time is taken up by advertising on American television. The dominant genre on American television is not sitcoms, it's not reality TV, it's not sport, it's advertising by a mile. I'll come back to that in a moment. Take other film, the film industry. Films used to be ad-free. Now there's not a film that comes out of Hollywood that doesn't have a slew of product placement deals, or that it isn't itself a vehicle for selling products. Witness every Disney film made. It's colonized every cultural form. Now, individually, all those ads are pretty innocent. Collectively, they are deeply political. If you think about this, some of the two big issues of our age, which are climate change and the global terms of trade, advertising has a pretty clear position on both. Yeah, don't worry. Everything is fine. You have to worry about how this was produced. Not relevant. Really not relevant. Nothing to do with you. Just enjoy the moment of consumption. And anyway, production is this sort of happy group of people that you might see. This Italian family making pasta or whatever it is. Deeply political discourse, but we don't recognise it as such. And I think we need to begin to do that. We need to begin to realise that advertising is political, and that we might begin to think about, one, reducing its presence in our lives, and two, some kind of right of reply. Maybe on television. I was at a conference actually a couple of weeks ago where I was talking to people in the television industry, and I said, maybe you should make a few more programmes that put the other side of the case. Because at the moment, it's a one-sided conversation. Now, all that cultural activity makes it very hard for us to think about other ways of progressing, because we are told over and over again that progress, that happiness, that solutions to every problem lies in one place alone, and that is through the consumption of objects. So it's very hard to imagine other ways of doing things. The third reason I want to talk about is what I call disposable news. Now, the news media is in many ways a kind of counterpoint to advertising. Advertising clearly is bound up with consumption. The news media is a space not for consumerism, potentially, but for citizenship. It's about making us better citizens so that we can operate in a democracy in a way that is informed, that we can take history even into our own hands if we wish. If you look at the growth of news over the last several hundred years, there are two competing notions that you get that in the news industry. One of them is a very democratic notion, that news is all about democracy, all about making us well informed. It's all about challenging conventional wisdom. The other is a very different idea, and it emerged at precisely that moment when news became a commodity. And that is this, that in order to make news profitable, you've got to make it short-lived. And so you get the sort of ultimate expression of built-in obsolescence, which is the newspaper. Here is an object that becomes obsolescent within a day. I've just read it, so let's throw it out, get the next one tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow. And the very phrase, yesterday's news, implies that if it happened yesterday, then it's of no relevance to anything. Now, that's a very effective business model, and it created the idea in our heads that the meaning of news was all to do with it being up to date, to do with it being current, an idea that has reached its apotheosis in the 24-hour news channels, where it's all about the latest, the current. And, you know, its currency, if you like, is its currency. It's about being instantaneous and up to date. Now, the first of those two notions, the idea that news is all about democracy, about questioning conventional wisdom, would imply that news is a space where we can talk about the things I've been talking about today. The second of those ideas makes it much more difficult to talk about that, because in many ways, it's a model of news that becomes the embodiment of a kind of business model of built-in obsolescence, so it's not likely to question it. We did a study of this. We did a study of newspapers in the US and the UK, where we looked at how newspapers were covering the issue of economic growth. And, I mean, one of the things I've tried to do today is to talk about how controversial, in many ways, economic growth should be. How, in many ways, there are all sorts of aspects to economic growth that are troubling, that means it should be a subject of debate. And we wanted to see how much of that was expressed in newspapers. We found, and you won't be surprised by this, that it, on the whole, was not. In 95% of occasions, economic growth was represented as an objective good. So it wasn't neutral coverage that just said, well, here's economic growth and here's some facts about it. It was coverage that said, economic growth is a good thing, we need more of it. If we don't have more of it, then that's bad. Doesn't matter what form it takes, we just want more of it. So consumption is good. It doesn't matter even if it's based on debt. We want more of it. So our news media, which perhaps could be the space in which we're debating these things, is actually a space in which we're replicating the same ideas. So what I want to suggest is that what we need to do, if we're going to think about other forms of progress, is to create more imaginative space. We need to change the way governments operate. Currently, governments intervene to support consumer capitalism, to sustain it and to limit its externalities, based on a model of built-in obsolescence. We could do something very different. We could say to companies, actually, you've got to pay for the cost of the disposal of the things you produce. We could even go further and say, we're not going to subsidise your waste disposal. We're going to subsidise a different group of people. We're going to subsidise those people whose job it is to fix things. I mean, remember them? You know, remember the time when, you know, if you're, you know, you had an electronic device and it broke, you could take it to a place and they would fix it. You know, that seems like, you know, a bygone age. But, you know, if you subsidised that industry and you made the cost of production the true cost of production, then maybe you would get a different way of producing things that focused less on their sort of temporal nature and more on the need for them to endure. A second thing we need to do is to treat advertising as political. I mean, imagine for a moment, you know, that whole world of advertising. Imagine if you told every advertiser tomorrow, you said, OK, as of tomorrow, you can tell any story you like. Anything. It could be about, you know, your pet gerbil or, you know, the day that you went for a walk in the woods. It can be about anything. Our entire cultural environment will be transformed. Because we would not be getting endless stories about the same thing, which is consumption. We'd be getting lots of different stories about all kinds of different things. What we should begin to do is try and think about how we might make that more possible. And that means limiting the space of ads rather than ever increasing it. Governments, on the whole, over the last 20 years or so, have created more and more space for advertising. They need to think about creating less space for advertising, but also to think about creating media that might begin to offer other points of view. And finally, I think we need what you might call a slow news movement. You know, we had a slow food movement that there was a kind of rebellion against mass-produced fast food that really wasn't very good for you. We need a movement that's a rebellion against mass-produced fast news that really doesn't tell you very much. We need news that endures. The idea that actually there was something that happened yesterday that still has meaning, that's still useful for us to know. And we need to embrace a different notion of newness in news. I mean, news says that it embraces the new. Actually, it only embraces the new in a very superficial sense. It embraces the new in the idea that it happened recently. It doesn't embrace new ideas, particularly. We need a news media that begins to do that. And once we start to do those things, then maybe we can imagine a world in which maybe we still have consumer capitalism, but we don't afford it quite the pride of place that it has now. And maybe we can think in the 21st century about other kinds of progress. Thank you.
You were just listening to Justin Lewis on consumer capitalism. This classic from the AR Archives was recorded at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. Justin Lewis is Professor of Communication at the School of Journalism at Cardiff University in the UK. He's the author of many books and articles on capitalism, media, and politics. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Kuhan Pakmander, Francesca Albanese, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Justin Lewis on Consumer Capitalism, and for Noam Chomsky's latest book, The Myth of American Idealism, How U.S. Policy Endangers the World, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Not only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.
Hi, I'm Ashley Judd, and I believe that when we listen collectively, change happens. And I believe we should listen to girls and women. I believe that girls and women should speak for themselves, with and for each other, about their bodies, their rights, and their dreams. That's why I think woman-made media is so important, and why we all need to tune in to Feminist Magazine on KPFK.
KPFK, your progressive media outlet, is listener-supported commercial-free radio. But did you know you don't have to wait for the station fund drives to support your favorite radio station? You can donate online at any time. Visit kpfk.org. That's kpfk.org. And we thank you for your support.
Soy Gregorio Luque y estás escuchando KPFK 90.7 FM en Los Ángeles, 98.7 FM en Santa Bárbara y por el mundo www.